Hey folks, Brian here, just letting you know that we recorded this before Michael Tonkin was DFA'd. That's all. Ahoy Mets fans, welcome back to Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World Series. I'm Brian, with me as always is Chris. And Chris, we just experienced something that you and I have not experienced many times in our lives. A Mets victory. That's a joke because we just felt an earthquake. Everyone who else on the East Coast who felt the earthquake, hope you're okay. Hope nothing fell off your walls. I thought one of my guitars was going to fall off the wall, which would not have been good. But they stayed on the wall, so that's a good thing. But in all reality, we are recording about 2 hours shy of a week into the Mets season. There's been 3 rainouts, 5 losses, 1 victory, a fight, all sorts of stuff has happened since the Mets started playing. But the important notes, or the bottom line here, is the Mets are 1-5 going into the third series of the season. And there's lots of things we can talk about, good stuff, bad stuff. But we like to do a vibe check on this show. And I know it's hard to have an accurate vibe check when you're coming off of 1 victory after 5 losses. But overall, if you're sort of putting on your process over results hat right now, how are you feeling about the Mets so far?
Not great. I think the 2 rainouts and then the, you know, coming into the doubleheader, it was kind of a nice reset a little bit, because writing about the way they were losing, on the Amazing Avenue recap front through the first 4 games was getting really bleak very, very quickly.
Yes.
All that optimism that we had coming right into, you know, into opening day, they signed JD Martinez. Everybody looked relatively healthy. Senga's injury being the worst thing that they had to deal with, at least looking at the first 2 months of the season. And that wasn't nothing, but I don't know, felt pretty good. And they just kept trying over and over and over to make us feel bad. If I take a step back from it all, I am not concerned about any of the really good players, specifically position players who are in this lineup. Nimmo and Lindor are not going to combine to hit, and I don't even cite batting average all that often, but what is it, like 050 or something? Mm-hmm. Individually, I think the players who you'd expect to be good are going to be fine. But man, 1-5 feels a lot better than 0-6 would have. 2-4 would have been nice if they could have held on to the first game of the doubleheader. But this is still the win was good, but they are still kind of in a situation that the next 7 days could be disastrous.
Yes.
And that's a little scary. When the Mets are good, like really good, 2022 Mets, I know in the end it was a tie and the tiebreaker went to the Braves for the division, but in the context of that kind of season, the series against the Braves wouldn't scare me as a fan. The Mets in Atlanta has always just been a weird thing. So there's that element that this first series against them coming up next week is 4 games and it's in Atlanta. But objectively, they're in different tiers of how competitive they are right now. This series against the Reds might be about as big a series as the Mets could have against the Reds in the context of the current rules of baseball. And playoff format and all that. Dropping 2 or 3 or getting swept by the Reds, going into Atlanta where seasons don't end in April. But I don't know, man. 1-8 if they were to not win a game in Cincinnati. with four in Atlanta, that would feel like it had the potential to actually end the season by the middle of April.
You're not wrong. It certainly would feel that way. So I'm going to take a slightly more optimistic look at this, only because I think there are a number of things that have gone well is overstating it. But let's talk about the stuff that has been good so far. The rotation, aside from Luis Severino, whose ERA got a huge help yesterday from a hit becoming an error after the fact. Aside from Severino, the rotation has looked pretty damn good so far. You know, Adrian Hauser had a good first start as a Met. Sean Manaea had a great first start as a Met. Jose Quintana looked pretty good in his opening day start. You know, Tyler McGill did not go very long and was hurt, but Tyler McGill was never supposed to be a regular part of this rotation. So I think that when looking at it, sort of looking for positives, I think right now how good the rotation has looked early on in the season is a good place to be positive. I will also say that Jose Budo, who came up yesterday to be the 27th man, looked excellent. As he has looked the last couple of starts he's made, he looked very, very good for the Mets. It's nice to have Budo maybe be a thing. Maybe he's a legitimate back end of the rotation piece if things don't go well for a Severino down the road. You know, I think that's been a good thing. I think Francisco Alvarez and Brett Beatty being offensive contributors, and in Alvarez's case being sort of the offensive contributor, you know, has also been a very pleasant, very good thing to see. All those things taken, you know, on their own are positives. Pete has looked okay. You know, I know he was a little bit shaky at the plate, so he started going the other way a bit, but you know, that's good process. I'm okay with that. The bad stuff, I mean, you mentioned Nimmo, McNeil, and Lindor not hitting at all. You know, that's not great. I think we could all admit how bad that is. But I'm not inclined to be super worried about them yet, as you said. Poor Michael Tonkin has had the worst probably start to a season I can remember for a Mets reliever. Just truly ghastly stuff. But again, it's a small sample size, and if Tonkin isn't fantastic, that doesn't really change the projection for the Mets this year. He's a small enough piece that if they needed to get rid of him, they could, and it wouldn't be the end of the world. So the results have not gone the Mets' way, but I don't feel like the team is totally in disarray. Then you add into the fact that you have JD Martinez coming up soon, and I feel decently fine about everything thus far. I know that's not a glowing endorsement or a sweeping heap of praise, but do you disagree with any of the stuff that I said?
No. Can I agree with all of it and still be...
Yes, absolutely. You can do whatever you want. I'm not the boss of you. I'm not your dad. You know, whatever you need to do is fine.
I mean, internally, you're the pod dad, but...
That is true, yes.
I feel like everybody else who's hosting a show is slightly younger than me.
Rob might be your age.
Rob, oh, old, yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. So there you go. But still, point taken.
Yeah. Well, I imagine that you'll be walking Opoto down the aisle. Not Allison, Opoto down the aisle.
Yes, when they get married to Baseball Prospectus. I don't know. I don't know what the bridegroom in the situation is, but yes. Anyway, but yeah, you can disagree. Disagree with me. Go ahead.
Yeah. I pride myself on not overreacting, on if anything, just being a contrarian with insufferably negative Mets fans. But I think I just need to see this next week happen without it being a train wreck. And, you know, if they come out of it with the same relative situation to 500 that they're in now, that's fine. You know, obviously it's not exactly possible. It's an odd number of games, but if they come out of it 3 or 4 or 5 games under 500, but they won some games during this stretch, that'll feel, I don't know, adequate enough for now. And of course, having such a bad start to things, you go into that Atlanta series being like, well, we're the underdog. Nobody thinks we win a single game of this series. I think that's always kind of a potentially dangerous spot for the favorite team to be in, being expected to win so heavily. Right. Obviously I'd prefer to just be the better team, but I don't know. It's a whole big bowl of, I don't know. There's enough there. I will say with Severino, right? I think the scoring change was accurate. I thought the play involved was an error. But whether his ERA was 10 or 5 going into the second start this weekend, the fact that he gave up 12 hits in not that many innings, that was probably the concerning thing. Obviously, a good number of strikeouts and no walks is always a good thing. I can find the positives. I just need to see a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But I will say that one thing right now, and I get it that people focus on the guys at the top of the order. Not something that I try to keep in the front of my mind when I watch sports, but a lot of people are concerned with who's making the most money on the team.
Right.
And, you know, putting the expectations on those players to perform. I get that you need more from those guys all the time because that's what they do. And I even get the whole, we want accountability and we want to see those guys just stand there and you know, take the questions and face it when things are not going well. Again, not really my top concern as a fan. If Lindor was just like, game sucked, peace out, and got in his car, I'm not going to be angry about it. But
right.
I get all of that. But because I think, and I want to say I know, it's that nothing is completely certain, but we all kind of know that those guys are going to be fine. Typically, you don't have massive declines in production. Jason Bay scarred everybody way too much.
Yes.
I think that's the most drastic example. I think a lot of other times the Mets have brought in players who were either dealing with an injury history or age, and there was some evidence of decline there that we just chose to ignore as fans because, hey, you know, Mo Vaughn at the time had a really good track record as a power hitter in his career. Pedro Martinez was very good when healthy for the Mets, but maybe sort of the mileage on his arm and his age and everything. The expectation should have been that things might not go perfectly well in the second, third, and fourth years of that contract.
Right. Or even Robinson Cano's contract, right? Or the trade for Robinson Cano, rather.
Right, right. Well, thankfully, that trade now looks great.
Right, because it's now the Edwin Diaz trade.
Yes. And, Kelnick is a platoon outfielder with the Braves, who's, still very young, but seemingly sort of hanging by a thread as a major league player. Yeah. Talk to me again in a week when he hits like 5 home runs against the Mets for his only good week of the 2024 season. But, and hey, in his defense, through 13 plate appearances, he's off to a roaring start this year. So, yeah. Anyway, my point, I had a point. I get the focus on the big names, but I think what we've seen in this early part of the season, if you have a 8-9 or 7-8-9 in your order that are pretty close to automatic outs, man, that magnifies the struggles of the big players. When a third of your lineup is just not even really capable of being productive, there's nobody there to pick up the slack. So, you know, Alvarez and Beatty have looked good. I mean, Alonso's stat line is probably not all that bad either, despite, you know, anybody who's watched all these games. I think we could agree that he's got a 139 WRC plus and he's hitting 292, 346, 542. And yet it feels like he hasn't been taking great at bats.
Exactly.
So Alonso, Alvarez, Beatty, that's all good. But the Bader, Short, Wendell, contingent, Narvaez even really isn't showing much as a hitter so far in his time with the Mets in his backup catcher role. It's tough because players are going to slump, even the best ones. And I just hope 5 days ago, my main point, if we had just recorded a podcast, would have been screw it, call up Gilbert and get Bader on the bench. I do hope that eventually it turns into that, because I'd much rather have an all-around good hitter in the lineup than a defense-only center fielder, who, by the way, that looks like he takes good routes to balls and is sure-handed, but there's been some stuff that, like, I'm like, that's elite center field defense? Like, he didn't get to that, or he didn't, you know, he goes to make a diving catch and it hits his glove and he doesn't catch it. If you're defense only, to me, you've got to make all of those plays, not just make center field look routine, which, you know, which is not nothing.
Right. And also, you know, it's a long season. At the end of the season, we're probably going to feel differently about Harrison Bader's defense. But for right now, I agree with you. It seems somewhat underwhelming.
Yeah. And every season around this time, it's very easy to overreact because you only have the information you have. And last season's stats are still very useful, I think, in sort of setting expectations and everything. But I mean, there's an off season and a reset, and most of these guys are probably not keeping everything about their game the same every winter, no matter what position they play or how long they've been doing it or how well they do it. I think a lot of them not only maintain pretty rigorous workout schedules, but consider things like various pitching or hitting labs. And, the Mets have one of their own now that their players can take advantage of. So you get to this point and you try to figure out things, even though you know you can't, you do, because what else is there to do as a baseball fan?
Right. You know, for the players that are struggling, McNeil's struggles make the most sense because he played so little in the spring. So yeah. I think that is both the easiest to accept and the player who I'd be most concerned about. Like, McNeil had a pretty bad, not bad year. After having a great year, he had a less than great year last season. So he's a player whose decline wouldn't totally shock me, but I'm not as worried because of the spring training situation. What's been most worrisome to me is how much Nimmo's been striking out, or not just striking out, but also swinging wildly at pitches out of the zone. That's just so unlike Nimmo that it's been a little bit alarming to see that. So I think in terms of actual worry, maybe that's where most of my feelings go in terms of the offense. Do you have a different player you're more worried about?
No, I mean, I think it's McNeil, right? And you're right. There's a perfectly good explanation for why he might not look sharp right now. His spring training injury was really the one that had the, I think the thing that we all associate with the Mets that is probably just common throughout sports, but the, it's a few days. Oh, it's been a week, but it's, he'll be back, you know, tomorrow, and then he's not. And
yep.
that sort of a thing. So there is an explanation for it there. When it came to bold predictions, the point of making a bold prediction is to try to make it somewhat unrealistic. So mine was that McNeil would bounce back and reclaim the National League batting title, which, hey, he is capable of that. But yes. That 2022 season in which he did it definitely looks like an outlier over the last 3 or 4 years. Yeah, way too early to start to think that this is just another one of those seasons that he's not quite the player he used to be. Yeah, but I think he's probably the one that I'm most concerned that I'll feel that way come July. I hope
he
makes the bold prediction look good and gets rid of this feeling entirely. But he's the one player who I think is most vulnerable to that. And that is me staying on brand and being a Starling Marte believer, despite his age. And look, he's looked good. We still got a long way to go before we can look at anybody's stats and say, hey, yeah, he's having a great season and it's going to look like one at the end of it. But Marte has at least looked the part of a major league outfielder and hitter in some of the Mets games so far. So,
yeah, agreed. Any of the pitching performances stand out enough that you want to talk about them?
Minaya was great. And really, Minaya and Budo, who were 1-2 in my mind in terms of the starts they put up. Hauser was better than I think anybody would have expected in his first start, too. And neither Severino nor Quintana was bad. That all sort of gets at the that optimistic thought that, hey, this rotation might be maybe not anywhere near the best in baseball, but it might be satisfactory.
Yeah, I mean, I did not get to see a lot of the Minaya game. I was out that night, but Minaya really impressed me his last spring start, and he looked great again on Monday. And Budo, at what point do we consider Budo a legitimate pitching prospect? Not prospect. I don't know what people, when that tag goes away for somebody, but when do we consider, like, hey, we should be getting Budo more starts? I think that if Severino, I mean, look, they're going to give him a longer leash than I would like them to because they're paying him however much money, $12 million, I think. But if he is ineffective in a month or a month and a half, I would much rather see Budo, if Budo is still throwing this way in AAA, come up and take those innings. Do you think we are getting close to the time when Budo is going to be forcing the issue with his playing time?
Maybe. There comes a time when it's just, okay, look at what he's done. And I think what he did in the late part of 2023, it's always easy to kind of take that with a grain of salt. It's late in the season. The team's out of it. There's not really any pressure there. And you get some things like DJ Stewart looking amazing. And in the very early going this season, that's not appearing to be a repeatable thing. But but with Budo, I don't know. All you can really do is say, hey, here's what he's done over his major league starts in 2023 and now 2024. And if everyone's healthy, which Tyler McGill dealing with the shoulder thing right now, currently on the injured list, that's a reminder that not everybody will always be healthy in any rotation. But if everyone's healthy and Buddha did what he did, and if everything's going reasonably well in Syracuse for him, you could entertain, even with Julio Teheran, you know, joining the rotation, and we'll see what comes of that. And we can talk more about that specifically, but maybe Buddha could bump Hauser to the bullpen. Maybe Buddha gives them sort of the sixth starter that they feel like they probably need when Senga comes back. Yeah, it's nice to think about him as an option who might have some real value, and not someone who in 2022, you know, they call him up to make one start. It goes very poorly. That never a fair way to judge somebody. And you feel bad for the player. That's it. That's their whole major league track record for that year. So yeah, it's very early in his good major league stint, but hey, it's now, you know, it's 48 innings with a 3.38 ERA, a FIP that's only a little bit higher, 3.86. I don't know. It's enough to say that he hasn't disqualified himself from making major league starts.
Yeah. You mentioned Julio Teheran, so we should go there next. Teheran was signed by the Mets to a major league deal worth $2.5 million. You know, there was a bonus podcast on Patreon this week, patreon.com/homerunapplesauce, where we talked about this a little bit, but, you know, you had written a very extensive piece about Mets pitching options, and then they signed a pitcher and, the doubleheader happened. And so it was, it sort of rendered the piece moot, but you were very adept at pointing out just how much pitching the Mets are going to need over the next few weeks. And so it seemed like they needed to have some sort of solution. And I think from that perspective, Teheran is a fine solution. He came, you know, $2.5 million is nothing, but it's very affordable. And if he's terrible, cutting somebody who signed for $2.5 million is not the end of the world. It seems like a better option than trying to make it work with the people currently in the roster, especially because the Mets called up a reliever when McGill went down instead of calling up Buddha or Lucchese or somebody else who could have taken a number of starts for the team or worked out of the bullpen. They went with a very limited option and called up Reed Garrett. So, you know, do you have any real hopes for Teheran? Do you think he's going to be a Met for a month? He's being met for the rest of the season. Like, how do you sort of feel about the signing and where he might fit into this team?
Yeah, not great. And I realize it might be kind of tough to be an advocate of the age old. You can't have too much pitching. Depth is good. But I don't know. He just doesn't do a lot for me. We're so far removed from when it seemed like he would just carve up the Mets,
yep,
every time they faced him. And in light of the signing, some of our Amazing Avenue friends had went and looked up his splits against the Mets, and they actually weren't as good as we all remembered. But I think that might have been due to some more recent starts against them. But in his heyday, it was just I don't know, the Mets couldn't figure him out at all. But That was a long time ago. Again, I mean, if I'm giving Buddha the benefit of the doubt for looking at what he's done recently and it being pretty good, then the same applies here. But it's one thing to look and say, okay, he had a mid-4s ERA last year. He was with the Brewers through a little over 70 innings. But there are some red flags within that. His strikeout rate was never spectacular, but it's really been low in the parts of recent seasons that he's been healthy enough to pitch. His walk rate last year was great, but that has not been typical, especially in the latter part of his Braves tenure or the years since that came to an end. So I don't know. Felt like a bit of a panic move to go and get him when the only people you could blame for being in this spot where they're dealing with option rules from the beginning of the season and the timing of calling people up and all that would be the Mets front office itself for deciding to replace McGill with a reliever and then put themselves in a spot that they need another starter who's not on the 40 unless they put someone else on the, another pitcher specifically on the injured list. So,
right. Isn't there somebody who might be eligible for a 60-day IL stint?
Well, in turn, Kranich, I think you could reasonably put on the 60-day IL and that, but he's, you know, since he's already on and not on the active roster, that can be useful to free up a spot on the 40-man roster for the signing without having a DFA anybody. But, I don't know. I hope it works out better than I think it will. I'm not too worried that he's going to soak up 150 innings and be bad. I think he's around to sort of help serve a purpose while there's two starters down. And then if he looks good, you can start to, you know, think about who's in what role as other guys come back. But yeah, I don't know. I know not everybody's going to be Jacob DeGrom when it comes to strikeout rate, but it's a little more annoying with relievers, but even with a starter, like a really, really low strikeout rate, just it concerns me. There's too much that can happen when the ball's put in play. And as much as the Mets hyped up defense as something they care about this winter, I don't think they're a bad defensive team, but I don't think they're an elite defensive team either.
Right.
So, yeah, we'll see. Yeah, do you have any more hope for him than I do?
No, none whatsoever. I think he will be probably, how can I say this? I think he's probably a better option for the next couple of starts. No, he's. If they had called up Buddha or Lucchese, I would rather one of those guys be the fifth starter for the next month than Tehran. But because they didn't do that, he was the best of what was left. I wouldn't want to bring up Christian Scott or another AA player who's not on the 40-man super early, mess with their development possibly just for these couple of starts. So, you know, in that regard, I think it's a fine move. $2.5 million is not a terrible amount of money to offer him. It's fine, but I'm not particularly enthused by it. I think once Senga comes back, and if Buddha keeps shoving in AAA, it's going to be a pretty short stint for Tehran. And that's fine. It'll be a great person to use on Immaculate Grid if anyone out there is still doing Immaculate Grid. Are you still doing Immaculate Grid?
Yeah, not every day, but still dabble.
I when I remember I do it, but I there are many days I don't remember anymore.
I feel like it's so hard to, for me, I know in the early days of it, there were some people who could get immaculate ones every day. You were better in that regard than I was, but
I wasn't getting it every day though.
No. But I feel like I love that it's there. I love that you can go to the archive ones. My favorite thing to do is specifically one friend, anytime I see a Mets column or row, it's a competition and he almost always wins, but every once in a while I pull out a victory, but it's just the Mets column or row and seeing how obscure we can get. There's some really fun Mets in there to get to do that with. But I feel like because it's so hard to make it immaculate, then you don't build in the addictive like streak function.
Exactly. Yes.
Or feature. And I'm sure they're still getting a good amount of traffic, but it's definitely faded in terms of being a trendy thing. So
yes. I was happy. The last time there was a Mets player, the last one I saw with the Mets, was, I think it was earlier this week, maybe it was late last week. It was Mets and Royals, and I got to use Ambiorix Burgos.
Oh, wow.
So I was really happy with that.
Nice. I didn't do that one yet, but you didn't spoil anything because I would not have pulled Burgos from my memory, and I won't just cheat and use that.
For some reason, that he lives rent-free in my head.
Yeah. That's for me, it's Roberto Hernandez.
Okay, yeah, there you go.
And that dude played on a lot of teams. And
yes, he did.
Is often forgotten as a 2006 Met.
Yes. The Duaner Sanchez replacement. They traded Xavier Nady for him because Sanchez
right.
in the cab accident. Yeah,
that's right. And but the kicker was that he was on the Mets in 2005.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
And then he starts the year in Pittsburgh. And right. And yes, you're correct.
I feel like the one era of the Mets that I know really well is like 04 to 07. That's my sweet spot.
Yeah,
I was doing the Leo DiCaprio pointing at the screen meme from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood yesterday, because on the Patreon bonus pod, again, patreon.com/homerunapplesauce, I mentioned how Mike Piazza had bought Willie Randolph a cigar to smoke when for the first victory, and he had to take it on the road because they lost the whole first series. And so when Gary mentioned it, I was pointing at the screen. But yeah, Julio Teheran, probably not good. Is there anything else from the first week of baseball that you want to particularly highlight for the Mets?
I actually think the bullpen's been pretty good. Tonkin, obviously, one, he's been deployed poorly. I think there's maybe legitimate concern over Carlos Mendoza's in-game management skills. Hopefully that sort of rights itself over a longer stretch. But aside, I know Ottavino gave up the home run, and I know Tonkin has just not been the right guy for the Manfred inning, as I have debated permanently calling it, but we'll probably only say it once. But the bullpen's been pretty good, objectively, despite not being perfect. But you really notice every imperfection, again, when the lineup isn't scoring. Everything's magnified. So with that said, I think that's a source for some optimism. And on Mendoza, I don't think most of his bullpen usage has been that bad. One of the games, Gary Cohen pointed out that, hey, this was a spot that we'd seen the Mets maybe be a little more modern and use Edwin Diaz in the eighth inning against the better hitters.
Yes.
And we saw that not happen once this week. You can argue whether or not you think holding on to Diaz or saving Diaz for free runner innings is a good thing because he's such a high strikeout pitcher. And obviously when you have somebody in scoring position by default, strikeouts have even more value than they do in a normal inning. I'm not going to say that specifically is the thing that concerns me, but going to Tonkin and then going to Tonkin again, it really can't happen a third time in that situation. Like, I think that's a pitcher who can do what he did for the Braves last year and throw two or three sometimes, innings, not in like just blowout mop up type situations, but that maybe where it's just a little bit lower leverage, your starter's pitch count got high, you're up two or three or four runs or down by that amount, and he can come in and throw a couple innings and keep you in the game or, relatively maintain your lead. That repeat decision, and then Brett Beatty bunting with the free runner on second to lead off an inning. That is just, I have no other word than, like, that's just dumb.
it's so dumb that it's almost comical. Like, I know what they're trying to do, but how? When was the last time Brett Beatty bunted? Like,
right.
It's a bad decision no matter who's at the plate, honestly, in that circumstance. But if you had a fantastic bunter up, I understand them making that decision and trying for because the one run is all you need in that point. If the one run is 90 feet away, then you can do a sack fly and win the game. I totally understand that. But Beatty's a young player who hasn't bunted very much, and the first bunt he attempted looked terrible. You take the bunt off then. But no, they had him take the try for a second one, so now it's two strikes on him, and then he got punched out. Just bad, bad all around. Really, really dumb.
Yeah.
But yeah, so.
Yeah, and I always hate the argument, oh, well, you only need the one run, but you had a pinch runner on second base. And I know this is a franchise that has one very famous wild pitch that helped it win a World Series, but
yes.
But for a regular season game, I'm not endorsing doing it in the World Series either. But your odds of scoring that runner from second are so close to how high they are of scoring them from third, especially right. When you factor in that you're giving away an out. Please don't do that again.
Yeah. You and I had debated the quick hook that Adrian Hauser got in the game over Slack. We were talking about this yesterday.
You know, I had
said that, you know, Hauser had started to fade and, you know, he had gotten warm for the game on Tuesday that got rained out. So it made sense to me. You argued that it was going to kill the bullpen. Both of us were probably right, but you were more right in the moment. And it did kill the bullpen. Do you think that's bad process or just bad luck in that circumstance?
I mean, I'll admit it's a tough decision to make, but I think it just falls into my general desire to see starting pitchers given a little bit more leeway. Yeah, it's early in the season, and if he sticks with Hauser there, it's entirely possible that the final score is the same or worse. So I'll acknowledge that, but it's a risk I was willing to take, knowing that you might have to cover a lot of innings, not only in the second game of the doubleheader, but because there's no off days anytime soon. So thankfully, it's funny, going into the day, I was like, oh, if Reed Garrett pitches in a game, things have gone totally wrong. And to his credit, he threw three innings and he was great. He was a big part of why the Mets got that win finally in the second game. But I was concerned about burning a bunch of relievers. Unfortunately, that is what happened. I think if it really got down to like another extra inning situation, they still had Johan Ramirez back from suspension. So it would have taken quite a few more innings to get to a point that you had to pitch somebody twice in the same day. But maybe it could have been an option. Certainly early in Budo's start, his pitch count was rising very, very quickly. And it looked like you might need three from Ramirez and three from Garrett. But yeah, I guess in the end, that decision didn't really break them for the day. I think most of the things that happened with the bullpen later in the game probably would have been about the same in terms of when, but I don't know. Pitch count wasn't that high, had been pitching well. I get it. And I usually like to think I'm one of the last to shake my fist at trends driven by analytics or whatever, but yeah, I don't know. I think sometimes if a pitcher has it on a certain day, they might be able to defy that third time through the order, or just pitch count over whatever, 60, 70, 80. They might be able to do a little bit better than they would on a normal day in that scenario. And to be clear, it's not like Hauser had like 12 strikeouts and a perfect
right,
but I thought, given the context of the day, I don't think you're being unfair to have him try to pitch a little bit more here. and help you spread out the workload over the course of two games.
Yeah, I agree with that too. You know, again, in a vacuum, it looks like a fine move, but then you factor in everything else that happens, and it's a mess. But that's the Mets, baby. So we got a weekend series with the Reds, then a series with the Braves. We'll be back probably after that series with the Braves. But until then, Chris, what is your music pick for this week?
So according to our spreadsheet, which is pretty meticulous, somehow I came into this episode not knowing the album I was going to record when we started maybe I'll record an album too, but I thought for sure I'd recommended it. It's been a big part of my rotation for the last few years. It was a combination of us starting to split our time between the city and upstate and then moving upstate on a full-time basis. And having gone to this band and their label, really, their festival in 2021, in a different part of upstate New York. But the band is Woods, not to be confused with either the Wood Brothers or the Woods Band, who you had recommended an album of.
Woods Band, yes, I did, yeah.
Looking back, I had also recommended the album The Woods by Sleater Kinney. So there's been plenty of Woods references, but this band is called Woods. The label is called Woodsist, and Woodsist was the festival. And I saw their set there, and I was drawn to it because Parquet Courts and Yola Tango were playing, and Kevin Morby. So those are three big ones for me. And I saw the Woods set there, and it was good. But it really took a couple of summers and listening to a couple of their albums. And then we got to a point that my Spotify Wrapped is always a little thrown off because most of my King Gizzard stuff is in my MP3 library for people who still know what that is. And
sure, Grandpa, let's get you to bed. Come on.
Yeah. But anyway, Woods wound up being my number one artist on Spotify in 2023. And that was surprising. I thought for sure it was going to be one or two other bands. But all of that is to say, my go-to album with them is still, came out in 2020. It's called Strange to Explain. And, it's just start to finish it. It's great. First two songs in particular, Next to You in the Sea and Where Do You Go When You Dream, are probably 1-2 in terms of, I might alternate which one, or 1 and 1A on the record, but I do love listening to the whole thing. So weather permitting, I might even be seeing them tonight, and it'll be nice to possibly get to do that in a context where I fully appreciate their music. For anybody who's listened to some of the past music recommendations, Woods has been around for quite a bit, and I still admittedly don't know their earliest stuff all that well. But back when they were making that, Kevin Morby was in the band and playing bass before he went out and decided to do a solo thing and make his name really his band name. And that worked out. So it's been pretty great. And it's always nice. I think a lot of times you see new projects come up because bands have these like awful falling outs or, you know, whatever, that everybody hates each other. Even a recent example, like Father John Misty had been in the band at least for tour purposes with Fleet Foxes for a while. And it sounded like that did not go well. And there's not a whole lot of love lost there in him doing his thing and becoming his own big thing and having nothing to do with that band. But in this case, everything seems like everybody's good friends and just went on to keep making a lot of good music in their respective bands. So, all of that is to say, Strange to Explain by Woods. I think it's a really great record. And one of the tracks, for those who are familiar with the sound of Peepers, they incorporated some like field recordings of Peepers into the track. So that always feels very appropriate. And we're just getting into that time of year where you start to hear them.
I'm not familiar with this term, Peepers.
Yeah, neither was I. Grew up in Connecticut, but didn't recall hearing them there. So they're frogs, little frogs who, if you're driving around at night, it sounds like a flock of birds is, you know, singing, sort of.
Okay.
And it threw us off so bad. And it would just be patchy, and you'd hear them sometimes. But my first instinct, you know, we didn't know that many people up here yet. Things were still kind of, and nowhere near normal COVID wise. And just like, what are these birds that like make all this noise in like the dead of night? And it starts in the evening, but you can hear them sometimes very late at night. And my Google skills, usually pretty good, but weren't, they weren't effective then. And then a friend, like a few months later, once we started to make friends and all that out here, was like, oh yeah, Peepers. And we're like, what?
I thought that was like a cutesy country term for crickets or something.
They're frogs, and it's a really cool sound. Now that I know what it, I enjoyed it before I knew, but now that I know what it is, I look forward to it. I'm assuming, without being a total expert on the frog, that it's like a mating thing, right? Most animal songs. They can get to be pretty loud. And I think a lot of times you'll really hear them if they're near water, in proximity to, even, you know, we don't have giant mountains out where we are, but if they're near even a small mountainside, that helps just project the sound that much more.
Sure. But, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was specifically that song on this record felt like everything just came together as like this new phase of my life was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Having a song that sounded like my backyard, it worked.
Well, it's always nice when you find a record that sort of feels like home in a certain way, right? So I totally get that.
So I'm gonna
go out on a limb here and pick my third consecutive instrumental record and my fifth in the last 11 picks. So, fans of instrumental music, you're welcome. Everyone else, I'm sorry. This is by far the strangest of those records, I think. It is by two upright bass players named Christian McBride and Edgar Meyer. The record is hilariously titled, "But Who's Gonna Play the Melody?" Because it's two upright bass players. And that's what the record is. There's, I think, one song each where... one song where one plays the piano, one where the other plays the piano. For the most part, it is just two upright basses playing bass together. And that might sound weird or amelodic. It is super melodic, actually. Typically, the melody is played by somebody using a bow on the bass. So, you know, sounding more like what you'd traditionally imagine a cello or a violin sounding like. Obviously much lower because it's a bass, but sort of that bowed sound. And then the other bass player acting as a rhythm instrument. The melodies are super strong. It's a really, really beautiful, dare I say, fun record. Wouldn't have expected it. From a pair of upright basses, but yes, a very, very fun record. And just you listen to it, you're like, how are these guys the only two musicians on this? But there's no overdubs. It's just a really, really interesting, unusual way to listen to music. And I am not including Chris in this because Chris has a very wide musical palette. But so many folks that I know just listen to the same type of stuff over and over again. I think it would be good for your brain to listen to two bass players play together for 45 minutes or so. So that's what you should do this week. You should listen to "But Who's Gonna Play the Melody?" by Christian McBride and Edgar Meyer. And
yeah, no, I so speaking of brains, Did you get into mine, or did we already talk this week about the fact that I'm seeing Christian McBride tomorrow night?
No, we didn't talk about this. Really?
Yes, really.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's going to be upstate. I don't know what the band format is. It's not the same one as that record. I think it's like a quartet. But
yeah, he's great.
I'm not 100% sure, but yeah. I've never seen him before. Have an appreciation for, you know, really good jazz bassist playing upright bass. And so we both picked bands, one intentional and one unknowing, that I should hopefully be seeing this weekend.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I did not. No, I would have definitely known that, because I'm a big McBride fan. So if you had told me that you had, you know, that you were seeing him, I would have certainly remembered that. But no, I did not know that. Wow, that's crazy.
Well, now you know.
Well, if you get a chance to talk to him tomorrow, say my podcast partner recommended your new album on our show. So
nice. Yeah. No, I hopefully I do.
Yeah, that's a very cool coincidence. But yeah, it's great. And I should say McBride comes from more of the jazz world. Edgar Meyer comes from more of the classical and bluegrass world. And so you put those three things together and you get this really interesting, cool sound. So yeah, check it out. What do you got to lose? Some bass playing magic. And now I'm very jealous that you're seeing them tomorrow night, because tomorrow night I think I'm doing nothing at all. So I guess I could drive up to see you, but that seems like a long trip to take. So, and who knows, maybe there'll be another earthquake and I'll be stuck in my house. Let's hope not. I don't know why I even brought that up again. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. You can find me and Chris on Instagram at Chris McShane, at Brian Needs an App. Go to homerunapplesauce.com for more information. And until next time, let's go Mets.